I'd like to call the Senate Committee on Health, Veterans Care and Committee on Health Care and Veterans Affairs to order today.
Good.
I know it's early in the morning. These 8 o'clocks every morning, boy. This is March 5th, Thursday, and since we have a full agenda and there are a number of people that need to leave, I want to quickly open a public hearing on Senate Bill 529. Senator Jackie Winters can start, and hopefully Senator Courtney will hurry up and get down here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jackie Winters, and I reside at 3218 Indian Wells Loop South. I represent Senate District 10. Its cities consist of Salem, Almsville, Turner, Monmouth, and Independence. Chair Mona Sanderson and I, I'm sure that Vice Chair Cruz will show up and members of the committee. First, I want to thank you for accepting my testimony today and hearing Senate Bill 529. I was recently a member of the Governor's Psychiatric Security Review Board Siding Work Group. This group held a lot of meetings and heard a lot of testimony from diverse groups concerning the issue of siding facilities for PSRB clients. And one of the consistent themes that we heard throughout this hearings was the need to educate and improve communication with communities. If we're going to be successful in establishing residential facilities and transitional housing for PSRB clients, we must overcome the often heard response from communities, not in my backyard or not in my neighborhood. Senate Bill 529 would require the Department of Human Resources to establish a liaison position to help communicate between the department and communities where they're planning to establish transitional housing for PSRB clients. I want to thank you for your interest and hopefully support of Senate Bill 529. Madam Chair, as I stated in my testimony, this theme was consistent throughout the hearings that we held and in grappling with the issue of siding for PSRB clients, whether it was the law enforcement community, whether it was the advocates, whether it was the professionals, all of which indicated that there was a need to increase and to educate communities while the department is going through this process. And for that, I offer Senate Bill 529.
Thank you so much, Senator Winters, and thank you so much for that, being on that group. It's an extremely, I think, controversial issue in the communities, and we need to do a better job. I agree.
Thank you, Chair. Ms. Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, Senator Morissette, Senator Morrison, Committee Administrator. Sure. Yeah, my testimony, I heard one of the, I just want to pick up on one, right after one of the paragraphs that the good Senator Winters made. Throughout the meetings of the Governor's PSRB Siting Work Group, we heard over and over and over and over again that one of the largest hurdles to establishing new facilities for transitional housing is education, education, education of, and communication, communication, communication with communities. For this reason, we have submitted this piece of legislation which establishes this position to aid in education and communication, education, communication. It's my understanding the department, spurred on by the work group, and recent experience with attempting to site new facilities has already, already directed a current staff member to act in this role. So it is my hope that it will be no financial impact in terms of this bill. So with that, this is critical. I am worried about budgetary things at the time. In fact, right after I testified on some of my bills, if you're at all interested, as soon as I heard there's a financial impact, I said, all right, then I don't want my bill to move forward. So I'm not saying that here because I don't know what the cost is yet, but because of the budget crisis. But if we are going to cite these things, it's clear to me after all the work that we've done, especially as well as living in this country, decent communication to be able to cite them in some communities. Otherwise, the backlash, the pushback is beyond description. I'm sure you all know that. So we're struggling here to find a way to do something about it. Anyway, thank you for allowing me to make my testimony verbally as well as to file with you a written statement.
Now, I think it's important for us to realize that when we establish these group homes, I believe if there's 16 beds or less, that we get federal match. And I don't, maybe we have people to tell us what that federal match is. So it's actually costing us more money to keep them, whether in the correctional system or at the Oregon State Hospital, than it would be to have them in a group home of 16 beds or less.
Chairman Sanderson, when you get to the cost figures, you're correct. The problem is when you're in a town hall meeting, their people's eyes just glaze over. The background of these individuals, that's all they want to talk about. You understand what I'm saying? And as well as the impact on property value. You know all I'm talking about because that's the big issue. In some ways, we have to deal with those issues more than the fact that it's saving the state money as well as it's better treatment to do it this way. But often it's very hard to get to those kinds of statements, at least at town hall meetings or the groups that I've been involved when you're trying to deal with one of these sightings.
We had two that I thought would be ideal in Gresham, and the neighborhood associations said no way.
Right.
Yeah, and so the city council went along with that.
Absolutely.
Okay, yes, Senator Cruz.
Madam Chair, thank you. The Dash 1 Amendment expands scope significantly, doesn't it? Because because it's not just CRB at that point, it's persons with mental illness, so it's doesn't that kind of take us into more of a, well, which is the direction we need to go, quite simply, because then we're looking at that community needs as well, not just state hospital clients.
Right. Go ahead.
I think, you know, mental illness is directly related to PSRB clients as well as the greater population. And I'm certain, I know that those of you and myself included who have worked on mental health issues, that the same issue applies when it comes to siting facilities in neighborhoods. And that is the Not In My Neighborhood. And there's been a lot of discussion over time about the real need to educate the broader community to mental illness, whether we're talking about a PSRB client returning or whether we're talking about individuals that are within our communities that we know require or need assistance. I think educating the greater population to the real issue of mental health is one that I don't think we can dodge. And yes, it is a little, it does encompass more than just PSRB clients.
Sure. Chairman Sanderson, Senator Cruz, I believe I was here a few weeks ago or a few days ago, this question came up in a different format. It's either you or Senator Morrison brought it up, forensic versus civil, and that's what's going on here. So you're right. That's exactly what the amendment does. I'm not opposed to the amendment. But again, the backlash is often there, whether it's forensics or however you want to describe mental illness in terms of not forensics. So, yeah, that's what it does speak to. So.
Yeah. Well, Madam Chair, I guess my point here is if we're doing fiscal on the bill and on the Dash 1, we might be looking at different numbers. We're not.
Could be. I don't know. I do not.
I'm getting head shakes.
We're
going
to have someone else come to speak to that.
I am not going to mislead any of you. If anything, I want to be low on funding because I think I know what's coming. And I'm not asking you to make exceptions because I'm involved with the bill. I'm just telling you what the amendment, I think, tries to do. It does broaden it. You're accurate. You're absolutely right, Senator Cruz. Is there additional costs? I do not know the answer. I have no idea.
Yes, Senator Morrison.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank both of you for bringing this forward. As you know, my community was one of the ones that was impacted by this decision. And I'm wondering, in the work group that dealt with this, what was the discussion with respect to the role of the community and the obligation of the community and how this siting process would actually engage the community?
Chair Mona Sanderson, Senator Morris, the work group did not no more than to discuss what the obstacles and barriers were in order to get siting in the first place. And those barriers pointed out that there was an increased need to educate the community first. There was an increased need to do a better job of communicating those issues surrounding not only the release, but to educate what really, when we talk about mental health, what that means and what that is. And working with your law enforcement, your school districts, and working with, you know, the all those entities inside of your community so that we better describe what we are dealing with, and hopefully through that process you're then able to get some buy-in from your community, recognizing that the community plays a role in helping to place and cite them. I think your community and others, with lack of, well, I think for better choice, is that when we lack knowledge about a given anything, we tend to be fearful of that which we do not know. And so when a community is educated, respecting whether it's the mentally ill, whether it is someone coming in your neighborhood that's a different ethnic group or what have you, there's a tendency that you can remove some of those barriers. And so that's the genesis of the legislation.
Senator Hangmas, if you're talking about the PSR work group, I wasn't on the work group. If that's what you're talking about. I wasn't on that work group, if that's what you're talking about. We were on the State Hospital Overseeing Organization, which somewhat touched on this area. And all I want to say is, before you can say what is the community's obligation, you have to understand, well, I'm sure you do, who am I, you all know this, it's my perception, it's just Peter's perception, that the community starts out, we have no obligation. These individuals are to be sent certain places and kept there. We want to be kept safe from them. That's how they view this. And they don't distinguish between forensics or civil, or however you want to describe it. You see some of these people as very threatening. And so you have an obligation, state, to make sure that that's the bottom line. And it's proved impossible, those are my words, impossible to get beyond that in many of our communities. My community, you just said something about your community, there's other communities. I don't want to indict any community here, but they're out there. So we have reached the point that there's no other way we know how to deal with this. I mean, you could try to force things, you know all that. When neighborhood associations, I'm talking neighborhood associations, are taking stands, that is significant. I mean, neighborhood associations are official organizations in neighborhoods, not just activists or people mad in the neighborhood. They are official organizations, and they're saying, not in our neighborhood. You got serious problems. How do you get the public to go along with this? And we've reached the point that this is the only way we think is left to do it, outside of, you know, you take police officers, we're going to put them there, we're going to, you know, guard them. That's how difficult this issue is, in my opinion, in terms of the state of Oregon now, whether it's your community or my community. This is a last step, last measure, to try to start to turn neighborhood associations and city councils and people in the community to say, can we sit down and talk? Can we, long before it's done, to try to communicate the kinds of individuals we're talking about, their background, what's involved in these homes, you know, how many, you know, the staffing, the whole bit. Because I've been through this right out from a few blocks from here, right from a few blocks. And I will tell you, it's unbelievable what has gone into preparing the home, the kinds of individuals. And when you sometimes sit down and you start to talk over hours and hours and hours and days, all of a sudden you can see some of the residents sort of fading a bit. They're not seen as threats to the children, may I say it, straight up. And that's when you start to the softening and maybe get a grudging acceptance, an outright acceptance. So, long, long answer to a question you probably didn't think you want that kind of answer, since I wasn't on this PSRB, but any group in this area is struggling the same way, I believe, right, as I've tried to describe.
Thank you very much, Senators. Let's call Lynn Ray. He's the only other one on this bill. He probably knows a lot.
Chairman Anderson and members of the committee, my name is Len Ray, and I am the administrator for Adult Mental Health Services with Addictions and Mental Health Division for the Department of Human Services. And I'm here to testify in support of this Bill 529. As you know, this bill requires the Department of Human Services to appoint a position to assist with the siting of facilities that house individuals under the jurisdiction of the PSRB once they have been granted conditional release into the community by the board. We have requested that amendments be introduced that will allow us to dedicate this position to a broader role in siting facilities and housing for individuals with mental illness, regardless of how people enter into our system. The department has learned through experience that working with communities in the development of these facilities is really essential to their success. We have determined that having a dedicated liaison to manage the intricacies of gaining community support is vital in this process. Currently, we have a dedicated staff to this effort starting in 2008, and that staff is a double filling of a position and using administrative funding from within addictions and mental health. We do lack the position authority, however, to continue this effort into the next biennium. Oregon, like all states, is faced with both the challenge and opportunity of transitioning individuals with mental illness into community settings when they have been deemed ready for discharge from the state hospital. The Americans with Disabilities Act and the Federal Fair Housing Act require that we create and sustain integrated home-like settings with the least restriction necessary for all people with disabilities, including people with mental illness. Since AMH has already started this level of activity, we do not believe this bill will have a fiscal impact for the 2009-11 biennium. However, we are asking for permission to establish this position to allow us to free up a double fill and continue to proactively work with communities to gain their support for siting new facilities or housing. Addictions and Mental Health and DHS concur with Senators Courtney and Winters and their testimony. I appreciate the opportunity for allowing me to testify today, and I'll do my best to answer any questions you might have.
Senator Morse, do you want to address the question that you asked of Senator Courtney?
Yeah, and maybe just to give a little more background, the history in my community was there was no preparatory work, and all of a sudden it was announced that we were having a psychiatric security sighting. And it just blew up. And what I'm wondering is, in this whole process, there seems to be a lack of recognition on the community's part and the leadership within those communities that they indeed have a responsibility, a legal responsibility in this process. And I'm wondering how you get that kind of mindset in these communities, that we're in this together, and provide the communities the opportunity to be engaged in where these facilities, these homes, would be located, as opposed to the Psychiatric Security Review Board saying it's going here, whether you like it or not.
Senator Morris Anderson and members of the committee and Senator Morse, I believe that the beginning conversations with city leaders about the establishment of a facility within the community is probably one of the first steps, and that's long before we have any dedicated spot or geographic notion really where the siting might be. It's really trying to engage the community into understanding what this facility would bring, what kinds of jobs the facility might bring to the community as well, what some of the inherent risks are, and what some of the inherent, I would say, positives are from having a community in the facility, a facility in the community. So we were thinking that if we engaged city leaders early, we could answer some of the questions that come up at town hall meetings and then go back to city leaders after we've had one or two meetings that really needed to be addressed at the front end, if you will.
Yeah, thank you, because I think that's the only way that we move this forward is early participation by communities. Thank you.
Senator. Thank you, Madam Chair. Let me ask the question a little different way, if I could. In the last 18 months, tell me how many of these you've actually successfully cited and what process you went through to make that a success.
Chairman Sanderson and Senator Bates, I don't have the exact number with me. I can get that for you, however. What we did was we had met with the local community mental health program and in concert with the PSRB in looking at where we might consider siting a facility. We had put forth a request for proposals at the beginning of the 07-09 biennium, and in that request we had estimated how many of the facilities we might need for any given population, given the numbers of people that were in the state hospital and the forecast that was provided to us. So that was the initial process of how we would site. And then once we had a provider who was wanting to work within the community and within the parameters of what we believe the need to be, then the provider would start looking for property and then start engaging the process of securing that property. We hadn't to probably September, October of last year, we hadn't really engaged any of the city leadership prior to us looking at any kind of siting in communities.
Follow up. What I'm hearing is you don't know how many you've sited in the last 18 months or maybe 2 years. Have you cited any in the last 2 years?
Oh, yes, we have. We have been successful. I just don't have the specific number for you. I can tell you that I don't want to give you misinformation. I just didn't bring that with me this morning. I'm sorry.
You have any follow-up?
Yes.
Any idea? We're talking 1, 100, 10, 2?
I will get you that exact information as soon as I get back to the office. I can tell you that we have cited recently. We've cited the facility in Cornelius, and that was after a long protracted series of meetings with that particular city and the community within which that facility exists. I'm going back, but I just don't have the specifics other than that.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Morris?
Yeah, well, thank you. In my community, the facility is not forensics. It's civilly committed. And that was the pushback of the community and kind of the compromise. But Madam Chair, I'm wondering if this issue does not deserve a little more prescriptive type of legislation that spells out the obligations of communities and the obligations of the state to site these facilities. I'm happy to vote for this bill because it's a step in the right direction, but I think there still may be unclear expectations on the part of the communities as to what their responsibilities are.
We don't have the graph, but I saw one graph that listed all of the people that had been cited, and I don't know if it was forensic or civil groups. And some counties have been very open because their percentage rate is of taking these patients are so much higher than other counties, and I think that would be very helpful to have.
Yeah.
Yeah, Sasha, do you want to come up?
Members of the committee, Chair Monis Anderson, for the record, my name is Sasha Pollack. I work in Senator Courtney's office. We've kind of been putting our heads together back there, and the number is less than 10 in the last two years to 18 months that the department has been able to cite. To respond a little bit to Senator Morse's question related to the community's involvement in this, the reason that Senator Courtney and Senator Winters chose to limit this bill is there are several other bills coming out of the work group, including one related to some sort of a group that the community would have to put forth, including public safety officers and community leaders that would communicate with this position. And this is Representative Olson's bill, and it would he describes it as the voice of the community. I like to think of this bill as the ear of the of the department. And so it's a give and take, and there's definitely roles for both of those. But this bill was limited to just the role of the department in terms of that. But there are bills coming down that I'm hopeful you will see that will add those pieces as well.
All right. We need to move on. Thank you very much. We don't have the fiscal, and we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 454. And could you open a public hearing on 605?
605.
You want
to read that? Yeah. I'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 605. Mr. Shook.
Yeah, I'm okay with it.
Senate Bill 605 allows certified nurse practitioners and clinical nurses who are approved to dispense prescription drugs to delegate non-judgmental dispensing functions to staff assistants under certain conditions.
Thank you. I don't know who you are. You just showed up. I didn't invite you.
Not on the list.
Not on the list. Senator Mona Sanderson.
Thank you, Senator Cruz, Vice Chair Senator Cruz. I'm Senator Lori Mona Sanderson. I represent Gresham, Troutdale, Wood Village, and Fairview. And this bill, Senate Bill 605, has been a series of bills that we have put forward over the last 10, maybe 15 years to help meet the problems that we have with access for patients in Oregon. Oregon is on the cutting edge regarding the scope that we have been that we have allowed nurse practitioners, and other states do look at us as a leader in the state. And I will not go forth with any more comments, but I did want to say that we are a leader, and with that, if you'd call the next witnesses up, that would be great. Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and come back up. I would also point out that three of the members of this committee are sponsors of the bill, so it's probably got a reasonable chance.
It's getting through.
This is called Pam, Kathleen, and Stephanie. Please come up.
Thank you, Senator Mona Sanderson and Senator Cruz. Am I supposed to be speaking to Madam Chair, or?
No, okay. She's the boss. She's the boss.
Okay. My name's Pam DeVisser. I'm a family nurse practitioner. I have been licensed in the state of Oregon for 20 years, and I have worked in a variety of settings in student health and public health and private medical clinics. I moved recently to the new Bridgeport Providence Clinic right off of I-5. And I come today on behalf of all of my nurse practitioner colleagues in the state. I'm also the chairperson for the Oregon Nurses Association Nurse Practitioners of Oregon Group, and have been involved with this dispensing issue for a number of years. As the chairperson, I hear of a lot of examples of difficulty with dispensing medications, and I'd like to present my written testimony to you. I know you can all read this, so I'm not going to go through this word by word, but I'm going to actually show some examples of how ridiculous some of this has become for us. What we're trying to do is to just change probably an error of omission when we put the bill together a few years ago. We thought that there would be no issue related to dispensing because the way the bill was written for physicians, that non-judgmental functions could be delegated. However, it was the opinion of the Oregon State Board of Nursing's attorney that because it wasn't specifically written in the bill, then it was not something that was intended. So if Senator Bates and I write prescriptions for patients, there's various ways that patients can get the bill or get the prescription filled. You can write a prescription and go to your pharmacy and get it. You can we can write the prescription, and the patient can send it into a mail order pharmacy, and then it goes directly to the patient. It comes in a box or a bag directly to the patient's house.
This is a good nurse in true action.
This is education.
Yeah.
There is another program that is being used a lot in Oregon for the low-income people. And this is a pharmaceutical company sponsored program called the Patient Assistance Program. What happens is we, again, write a prescription. The patient is low income and they have no medical coverage. They may have insurance, but no medicine coverage for their prescriptions. And so then we write papers. It's two or three pages of papers documenting that this is our patient and we've prescribed this medication. We write what the patient's allergies are, what their other medications are, what their problems are. And then that medication assistance paperwork and the prescription goes off to the pharmaceutical company, and the pharmaceutical company will often mail that prescription directly to the patient. Again, all of these are going through a pharmacist. The pharmacist is dispensing all these. If that patient has the prescription written by Dr. Bates and it goes through a certain pharmaceutical company that says, well, we want to deliver this medication to your office, then the prescription comes to Dr. Bates' office and he has somebody in his office that gives this box, this prescription, to the patient. The patient can come in at any time, whether Dr. Bates is up here in session or if he's in the office, and pick up that prescription. If the same prescription is written by me and goes to that same pharmaceutical company and the pharmaceutical company elects to not send it to the patient but to send it to the office, then I physically have to be present to hand it over to the patient. And you can see where in rural areas and in areas where maybe a nurse practitioner is moving from one clinic to another, as is often the case, then it's more difficult for the patient to actually pick up the prescription. All of these scenarios, it's been reviewed by a physician, actually packaged and dispensed, but then the actual hands-on delivery is the only difference, and that's what we're asking for here. Let's take this very simple, non-judgmental piece of the whole problem out of nurse practitioner hands and give it back to somebody who's just capable of physically handling something. If you go to a pharmacy and you've been there three times already to pick up this prescription, the pharmacist doesn't come and have to re-educate you. They want to, but you know, you always say, no, I've had this before, I don't need this. The other situation that comes up is in certain clinic settings. And for instance, these are like the student health centers, the family planning clinics, migrant clinics, and so forth. Those clinics have come up with some prepackaged forms of medication so that they can be dispensed quickly if that patient doesn't have access to a pharmacy because of the distance they travel. So for instance, things like birth control pills, Diflucan, everybody knows Zithromax this time of the year. These are prepackaged forms of the whole prescription. And these, if they're written by Dr. Bates, can be given by anybody in the office to that patient. But again, if it's a nurse practitioner, then they have to actually be physically handed the medication by the nurse practitioner. And it's just a matter of, you know, the actual delivery system that's the problem.
And is there names, prescription label put on each one?
Right. They all come with pre-printed labels. The actual prescription has to be written. With electronic medical records nowadays, a lot of these things, you know, are very easy. It doesn't require a lot of writing. It's just the hassle factor sometimes of actually physically having to take a couple minutes to go get the medication and hand it off, where you could be moving on to the next patient.
So whoever is dispensing it, all they have to do is find the patient's name.
Patient's name and match it up to this name on the package. So I'm just asking that you consider the difficulty that we've had and try and make these situations better for patients, make the situation better for those of us, especially in primary care. Primary care access is very difficult, and anything that we can do to speed up and facilitate this process would be helpful. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'd just point out that I think this was our intent and what we thought we were doing until the lawyers got involved. So so this is simply a clarification of legislative intent.
Exactly right.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Stephanie Schmidt. I'm a family nurse practitioner at Willamette Family Medical Center here in Salem. We're a nonprofit family medical practice office. We see a number of medically indigent patients on a sliding scale basis. That number is growing all the time. Regular adherence to a medication regimen is important for many of these patients to control chronic conditions such as diabetes, high blood pressure, seizures, mental health problems. We make use of the pharmaceutical manufacturer's patient assistance programs on a regular basis so that our patients won't face impossible choices such as whether to buy food or buy insulin, whether to control blood pressure or pay the electric bill. Such medications are mailed by the manufacturer to my office where the medications are dispensed to the patient. The current rule, which requires nurse practitioners to personally hand medication to a patient each and every time the patient comes in to pick up these patient assistance medications, creates an obstacle for the patient and takes valuable time away from other patient care tasks. When there is a new medication or a change in dose, of course, I always take the time to personally go over the instructions with the patient. But when the patient comes in for the 15th or the 30th time to pick up their regular medications, there's no danger in delegating that task of handing the medication bottles to the patient, to a trusted staff member. The bottles are labeled with instructions and my office phone number should the patient have any questions. At that phone number, a nurse practitioner or a physician assistant is available 24 hours a day. As surely as you and I don't want to wait for the pharmacist to personally dispense our routine refills when we go to the pharmacy, my patients don't want to wait for me to personally dispense their routine refills. And as surely it is safe for a non-professional staff to dispense routine refills at the pharmacy, it is safe for my staff to dispense routine refills to my patients. This benefits patient care because it frees up my time for a multitude of more complicated patient care tasks. Also, it makes access easier for the patient, makes it easier for patients to stay on their medicines, to control their chronic conditions. Control of chronic health conditions keeps people out of the emergency room. Control of chronic mental health conditions keeps people out of the legal system. Thank you.
Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee, I'm Kathleen Krall. I also employed at Willamette Family Medical Center. We see at least 25% uninsured, last I checked, and I think it's probably 30% today. No. I have an Oregon RN license, FNP license, and the special dispensing license through the Board of Nursing, which there's a lot of regulations there which will protect patients. And we just want this one particular part that's very cumbersome changed. I'll just give an example. I know you can read the rest of my thing, but I have a patient who lives in an outlying area. He has he works a low-income job. He has no benefits, so no time off, no insurance. He has multiple chronic health issues, and he gets, I don't know, five or six different medications from different drug companies. So we have no control over when they come. You know, they might come the day after he's been in for his regular appointment, and he can't afford to come in for a special appointment. You know, he has to pay the gas cost and the, you know, the clinic fee and everything. If this change was made, then any medicines that were there at the time of the appointment, he could just pick up. Afterwards, you know, even his family member would be able to, who works in Salem, would be able to pick them up for him and deliver to him. So it would save him a tremendous amount of money. And as everyone else has said, it would save us a lot of time. In our clinic, we have MDs as well as NPs and PAs. And it's very confusing for the office staff to have, well, oh, yeah, you can do that for that patient, but not for that patient because, you know, Kathleen prescribed that one instead of Dr. So-and-so. You know, and it's just, it's a constant issue there. So I think because of the healthcare situation, we can expect that the numbers of people on these programs are going to continue to grow. And, you know, lately I haven't wanted to put anybody on it because it's such a hassle. But if this, you know, passes, we would be more willing to do that. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there any discussion? And there's no opposition, so I'll close the public hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill 605. And colleagues, before we do the motion, I want to make sure that we're okay. It says minimal expenditure impact. Now, if it says minimal, can we still take it straight to the floor?
Absolutely.
All right. We're in work session.
Madam Chair.
I don't know.
Just trying to think, why would there be any impact at all?
I know.
That's a hedge. The word minimal is a hedge, okay?
Yeah. I mean, this is about nurse practitioners being able to work at the top of their license.
That's right.
Yep.
That's all it's about.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 605 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Yes, Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 605 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? And note, Senator Morissette is excused. With that, Senate Bill 605 is passed. I'll carry the bill, and we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 605, and we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 54. And with that, John Powell. And would you remind us what this bill is all about? And we probably, I know that Senator, in fact, after Mr. Powell is, I might ask, I don't think
Dr. Smith is,
or Carol, to just give a brief overview to the two members that weren't here on Tuesday. Okay, go ahead. So, no, you go ahead first since you have to get out of here.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm just having passed out to you a few pages from the Health Insurance in Oregon 2009 report. And it's very well done, and it's full of very, very good information, most of which is public information that's on the website, and they consolidate it into this form. House Bill, or Senate Bill 454, Madam Chair and members, you know, first of all, I'm John Powell representing Regents Blue Cross and Shield of Oregon. We do not think Senate Bill 454 is in shape to be moved out of the committee. There are several bills that deal with the subject matter of this bill still being introduced. I think some are going to be printed later this week, and I think hearings are going to be scheduled as early as Wednesday of next week in the House in terms of regulating insurance rates and administrative costs, which this bill does in part. This bill does other things that deal with hospitals that I will not address, and you've had some testimony on those. Regents has supported transparency, Madam Chair, as you may recall from several sessions ago, to the point of us having other interest groups very angry at us at times. Senate Bill 501 was stuck in the after passing the Senate in the House. We were partially responsible for dislodging that and passing it. It requires health insurers to report annually by line of insurance how much their rates have gone up, what the profits are by line, and that sort of thing. That's all public record. It's on the website, and we believe we should be transparent, and we try to do that. What I've handed to you is four or five sheets from the last report the insurance division has put together, and I'm going to speak specifically to Regents and for the most part on this, but I think it's instructive when it comes to the section in Senate Bill 454 that deals with administrative costs. I think there's a lot of misunderstanding in this building about this issue and many, many others when it comes to health care and health care reform. I think a lot of people are talking past each other instead of to each other, and I think that's very unfortunate. And I hope that before we get out of here that there is a chance for everybody to come together so that we can all be supportive of health care reform, because we all know it's necessary. On The first page of the handout that I've presented to you is page 28 of the report, and it indicates the medical loss ratio of all health plans, the eight largest health plans in Oregon, which write most of the business, is 89.76 in 2007, and the latest is 89.4. Which means more than 89 cents out of every dollar of premium goes to pay medical expenses. The following page...
John, is this Regents or is this...
This all eight.
All. Okay.
On the following page, in the lower right-hand corner, the bullet in Oregon, 90 cents of every dollar paid in premiums goes to pay medical claims. Medical costs are currently driving premium increases, and those costs are real. They're real for a whole host of reasons, and we're always asked, why is it that a doctor's billing may go up 6% one year and the hospital bill goes up 8% or something? How come the insurance premiums go up a greater percentage than that? And there are a whole host of reasons for that, but primarily it's utilization. There are more tests, there are more appointments, there are more of everything in healthcare every year. And my own example, I needed a prescription for my glasses. I couldn't see anymore. I go to the same doctor for the same thing, 3 years apart. This last time, there's two new machines. One to test for glaucoma, other than the pressure test, by testing your peripheral vision, which will allow them to find it quicker. So I went into a room with a computer, put my face in a screen, and subjected myself to all this, yes, I see it, I don't, you know, all that sort of thing. The second test couldn't be done while my eyes were dilated, so I had to come back. So I went back, took the second test, different operator, somebody trained on that machine. So now in the file in my doctor's office, there is a picture of my optic nerve from this one test and a pie chart showing the thickness of that optic nerve, which probably presents a liability for that physician to make sure the next time I go in they do that again to see if I've got a problem, a degenerative problem. But the point being, 2 or 3 years earlier, it cost me under $200. Get my prescription. This time it was $600. I went in for the same reason. I came out with a different product, tests, files, that sort of thing. And I kind of didn't know what was going on. Next time I go in, I probably will say, no, I don't want to. I don't think I need that unless you're telling me I got it.
Madam Chair.
Yeah, send more, sir.
John, just out of curiosity, was that an optometrist office that did that test and then would send you to an ophthalmologist, or did you go to an ophthalmologist?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Morissette, I went to an ophthalmologist that I've gone to for several years.
Okay. Optometrists will do some tests and send people to, but I was wondering if that new machine was in their office.
No, this was an ophthalmologist.
Yeah, okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, optometrists have that machine as well. Last time I got my eyes checked, I had the same thing, and they talk about how wonderful it is because it's a better diagnostic tool. And you just accept it as, okay, fine, do it, which is basically what John said.
Yeah,
so.
Okay.
The third page in what I've handed
Senator
you.
Senator, if we had this discussion, let's have the discussion, okay? The question is it value-added? That's the real question. Is that kind of an added expense value-added in picking up more glaucoma patients in preventing blindness? And that's a very good question, and one we have not answered in medicine. We keep adding on more and more technology, and does it really bring enough value for cost? And that's your real question.
Yes, it is.
I believe. That's your real question. And I can't answer that for you.
And Madam Chair and Senator Bates, my general practitioner has very strong feelings about tests, all kinds of medical tests, and has very few done on himself. Things that in here we would get all excited about probably mandating. And the reason is it's very important if you're the one person that had that test done at exactly the right time, that that test indicates there's a problem and there is medical intervention that will save your sight or your life. But when you multiply that by millions across the country getting that test, there are very few times that that happens. For example, my general practitioner looked at me the last time I went in and grinned and said, "You know, you're not going to live a day longer because you come in here once a year." Now, in general, he's right. It could be.
You may want to change practitioners.
It could be that I happen to walk in there on a day when I can be diagnosed with something that I'm going to drop dead of tomorrow. The chances of that are pretty slim. And he gave me a case. He had a person die from colon cancer 14 months after having a colonoscopy, found absolutely nothing. This person had no history of cancer in their family. So the question is, in terms of public health, where should these dollars go? Those are the types of questions that are going to have to be answered to make a dent in medical costs. And that's why I'm trying to present the information I'm presenting this morning.
And there's two other questions that have to be answered. Not only did that test bring you value, and you can run that across an entire spectrum of questions, that's one thing. Secondly, is there incentive for the physician to do the test financially? There is. And thirdly, let's say your ophthalmologist doesn't run that test and you get glaucoma 6 months later and you end up in court with him because you've lost your sight, and that ophthalmologist has to tell the court, "I didn't do everything I possibly could have done to check this patient out because that new machine was available. I could have had the machine, could have had it in my office." So there's a liability thing of defensive medicine. There's an issue of incentive for physicians to do these things, and it's driving healthcare costs right through the roof for minimal or no gain.
And that's why we really need to start looking at talking to providers and giving the patient the option of whether they want a test or not. And I will refer to a stress test. I knew that I didn't need a stress test, but my physician really felt that I needed to have one. And so I did, and that's... I forget what the bill was from the hospital, $1,200 or something like that. And it says, "Golly, you are in good physical condition. You know, why did you have this test?" And I said, "Because my doctor really felt I needed it."
And Madam Chair, there was somebody not too long ago of public note. I don't watch those 7 p.m. shows, so I don't know the actors and all those people very well. But somebody had just had a stress test and then and died.
Oh, thanks.
So, get back to the point that Senator Bates and I, the discussion we just had, having a test may create a false sense of security. It doesn't mean
4% failure rate.
So you're just going to...
Yeah, not preventative, it's diagnostic.
Again, the third page that I handed you, which is page 25 in the lower right-hand corner, is specific to net underwriting gain and loss. Regions is the eighth company down on that column, on the left side of the column. If you follow that to the far right, the five-year average of net underwriting gain and loss at Regions is zero. Year-to-date, minus 1%.
Which means
minus investments where in the last 5 years we've not made any money. Zero. If you turn the page, you get to the net, Madam Chair, which is slightly better. And it shows you each year. In 2007, it was 1%. That includes investments. And year-to-date is zero. And all eight in 2007 averaged 3%.
So your stockholders didn't get any...
Madam Chair, this is... Well, Regents obviously has no stockholders. We're a non-for-profit organization. company, and at the end of this, it'll demonstrate that while we're a non for-profit company in 1986, when the federal government passed the Big Tax Reform Act, Regents became a tax-paying nonprofit, and we do pay a sizable amount of taxes.
Madam Chair,
both
yes,
the state
Senator
government.
Yesterday was Realtors Day in the Capitol, and I met with a number of realtors from Lane County. And I think there are 24,000 who belong to the association, and they did have insurance, I believe, many of them with your company. Only about 800 of them, though, of the 26,000 actually had insurance. But your insurance rate went up for small business individuals, I think, 24% out of a possible 25%. Now, is that factored into your bottom line in this sheet here?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Morissette, all lines were factored into this. And the what we file with the insurance division on an annual updated basis is broken down by small group, large group, and individual policies. And specific to a group, when you have 26,000 people and only 800 of them sign up, can give you an indication of a spiraling or a death spiral in insurance terms.
Follow-up, please. It was interesting because of various reasons. Some were young and healthy and didn't want insurance. Others had spouses who had insurance and so on. But you did not raise the rates on larger groups, is that it? Or if you did, it was
Mr. Chairman, Senator Morissette, most of the large groups are individually experience rated. For the most part, they're large enough that they can sustain their own viability in terms of rating over time. Mm-hmm. And so those are negotiated, but they've all been going up because of the cost trends.
Yeah.
They've all been paying more.
Okay.
General Motors has the same cost trend on their health plan that an insured plan does, and they're totally self-insured. I can't remember how much of a car that you purchase is health care. When it's a General Motors car, and most likely at Ford, those are totally self-insured plans. General Motors, there was a documentary done a few years ago about General Motors, and they have had cooking classes, exercise classes for their employees, and done everything that they possibly can to lower their health care costs. But they basically just write out the checks out of the corporate income, what's left of it, to pay for their health care. And we find the same with other self-insured groups. The trend is the trend.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair, the next to the last page is page 23, which indicates the general administrative expenses of all 8 health plans. Again, Regents is toward the bottom on the left side. The 5-year average is 8%, 8 cents on the dollar. And finally, the last page is the page I referred to earlier, which shows the taxes and the fact that we paid almost $16 million into the OMIP fee. That is, our policyholders did $16 million to subsidize that high-risk group. And as we've said before, access to health insurance in Oregon is universal. If you cannot get an individual policy underwritten, you have access to the OMIP group, which is heavily subsidized by all the rest of us who pay insurance premiums. So everybody in Oregon, regardless of their health status, can purchase health insurance. And a series of reforms in the 80s and 90s brought that about, which is good public policy. It's also, I think, instructive, Madam Chair, to know that based on our 2008 individual rate filing that has been misinterpreted, I think, in most quarters, the fact that 4 years earlier we had reduced rates by 16% in order to give surplus back to our policyholders, I think has been left out of that equation, and the 26% rate increase took over and became dominant. And even with that 26% rate increase at the end of that, over that five-year period, our rate increases in individual lines was single-digit. And I don't think there was anybody else doing single digits over a five-year period like that.
Madam Chair,
yes, yeah,
and I do have to give credit where credit is due. I understand that you did make a significant cut several years ago and caused some discontent in the industry as a whole. Others were increasing their rates, and then you finally got to the point where you had to play catch-up, which is what you did, I understand, in that.
And Madam Chair and Senator Morissette, the regulator regulates us both for not having enough money in reserve and having too much. And it was felt at that time that Regions was carrying too large of a surplus. And so we did not do this on our own. We did this in conjunction with the regulator in order to bring about. I do have a chart, and quite frankly, I was insured in this line of insurance, and I appreciated very much the break I got during that period of time. It was very helpful in my business. But I'll make sure the committee gets a chart. I finally convinced Regions to produce a bar chart, which actually is instructive, which shows you the premium for each of those years.
Yeah. Thank you.
And we are reporting on that basis, and that on our administrative expenses, the following on a monthly basis to the regulator: direct operating expenses, sales and marketing expenses, membership and billing expenses, customer service expenses, claims processing expenses, medical management expenses, and underwriting expenses. In the indirect operating expenses area, we're reporting based on the cost of facilities and actuarial and IT systems and other projects separately. So we're basically being monitored in a way similar to a regulator monitoring a company that's having solvency trouble, and we're not. But it's an agreed-to process saying here's the rate needed on a monthly basis. We'll show you exactly what's happening financially with that line. So, Madam Chairman, the point is, I think there are many, many vehicles that are going to deal with issues of insurance and insurance administrative costs in the process. I'm not exactly sure how the coordination's going to work because we have House Bill 2009 and then these other bills that are coming out now. And I don't know that they're all going to go to the same committee.
We're having discussions with that, just to let you know that we are working on trying to coordinate with the House, and because this is an extremely complex issue, and your point as well.
Given. Thank you for your indulgence.
And Senator Cruz?
Yeah, Madam Chair, John. All those individual lines, the regulator looks at all of them. Is there any of them that the regulator can't intervene on and say, you're way out of balance here?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Cruz, we have to file our individual and small group rates, and they look at those actuarially, and that process is not a one-time look. It goes back and forth, and more questions are asked, and there's going to be a result down the road. So both parties, the insurer and the regulator, the people who actually do that work, are invested quite heavily in being right. So it is a refining process that takes place, and they usually get pretty close.
Madam Chair, I guess the point I just wanted to make was the fact that there's due diligence done in all components of the rate setting, and I think it's a good process the way it works now.
Yes, Senator Bates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. John, thanks for coming here today. Appreciate it. I think there was a lot of misinformation, and we have a tendency to blame the insurance companies when because insurance rates go up, and sometimes you're more of the messenger than anything else. But, hey, we're Americans. We blame the messenger, okay?
There you go.
I do have one question for you, though. I mean, I agree that utilization, uninsured, and utilization being driven by things we've talked about already, high-tech, do everything you can, cover yourself because of malpractice. But there's also another factor, and that's the individual who, the individual patient, stepping up and saying, we don't need anything done also. So, and the insurance companies can offer something, I think, that can help with that. And the question is your company now offering a preventative plan that also includes major medical, but that I mean a plan that would cover preventative services, which we want people to get without restriction, then having maybe a $5,000 or $10,000 deductible before major medical kicks in. And if you are offering that kind of a plan, what's the premium look like on that?
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, there are different plan designs on the drawing board, and the HSA type of a program has significant lower premiums, obviously. The problem with all of that is that it used to be a $1,000 deductible, you got a huge break, but now you go through $1,000 in medicine in just one little episode on something that's not too serious. And so the amount of those deductibles are have to be pretty high in order to get the premium down. But there is a lot of innovation going into making sure that children get all the vaccines they need, although in your part of the country that's controversial language.
Only one small part of the country.
Okay. Yeah. And
it's not in Medford.
And getting people examined when they need it and those sorts of things on a lower cost or closer to first dollar coverage. But you will see bills this session that, again, take some of that innovation away by forcing insurers to pay for a specific drug, those sorts of things which hamper that kind of innovation. And that's what we're worried about in the total of reform, is that one size does not fit all. And if you regulate administrative expenses in one way for regions, a company like Kaiser that has a different model, and thus many of their what would be an administrative expense at regions would be a claims expense at Kaiser. So their administrative expense formula is different simply because they are a doctor-owned organization that performs many of the functions that Regents does by hiring staff doctors on staff, and so they're different. And we're hoping that there's an accommodation for that, and that one size would not fit all. I will try to get you some premium information on different products that Regents is coming out with.
Thank you. Can I ask two other quick questions?
Yes,
these are about how holding costs down. Another proposal that's been brought forward by the industry is the idea of excellence and efficiency. And are you looking at policies that would say to a patient, you need a bypass, you need hip replacement, you need a knee replacement? We understand that. We have three areas in the state where for cost and for quality, we think this is the best place, and we're going to send you there. You may not be seeing your local provider for this because they charge more. Let me give you an example of that. One of my patients who does not have health insurance except for a $10,000 deductible is going to have surgery this week on some nasal polyps. He and I did some shopping on that. The range and price in the Medford area for that operation, for the follow-up care for it, was $6,000 to $18,000. There's something wrong with the system in healthcare where that's kind of that kind of price differential occurs, and the quality of care from both places was the same. He shopped it through various ear, nose, and throat specialists, anesthesiologists, ambulatory surgical care centers, and got the price down to $6,000 from $18,000. Would you as an insurer help one of your insureds go through that process, or are you just going to write a check for $18,000 for one and $6,000 for the other?
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, that's a difficult question in that Regents contracts with most physicians for fees in advance. Those we get a lot of pushback on that. And the reason for our model is to try to curtail the outliers who charge those prices, and to serve our members by reducing those overall costs. So we try to do that up front. We do have, and we did support legislation to create the beginning of an online system where a patient can go online at Regents.com, get the best guess at what their out-of-pocket costs would be in a situation like that. The statutory requirement is to take the most frequently performed procedures and do that with. Eventually, what we hope at Regents.com is it will be almost all procedures and providers where you can go on and actually get that kind of information in your home. And if you need help, call up. These are, again, examples of administrative expenses that we think are very, very valuable over time.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Right. Senator Morris?
Madam Chair, thank you. Senator Bates, was this person uninsured, did you say?
He had a $10,000 deductible. He's an individual. He's an optometrist, actually, and he can't afford the full benefit plan, so he buys a $10,000 deductible, and then he goes out and starts shopping when he needs something done. And it's just a crazy system.
Yeah.
That's insane to have that kind of change in cost.
Yes.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Morris.
Quick question. John, how valuable is FEOP to your program?
Madam Chair and Senator Morissette, we think FEOP is an excellent program and one that should be expanded.
I'm asking Dr. Bates to pay attention to this, please. Would you repeat that?
Okay. We think FEOP, the question was, is FEOP important to Regents? And we do think it is a very, very valuable program and one that should be expanded.
Okay. Yep. Thank you. I wanted to make that point.
All right. You had to be somewhere at 9:15. Tom, all right. Thank you very much.
Your scheduling is...
I know. Tom Holt said he had to be somewhere at 9:30, but he is now not here. So I assume
maybe
we will...
At 9:15.
He might be in the hallway.
So, he was 9:15. Tom said 9:30, but that's all right. Okay. So I'm just going to rather... I think that I'll go through some negatives before we go through some positives. All right. Alan Tresider and David Schlakis.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is David Schlakis. I'm the CEO of Willamette Surgery Center and Willamette Orthopedic Group in Salem, Oregon. I also serve as the chair of the Government Relations Committee of the Oregon Ambulatory Surgery Center Association. Thank you for allowing us to be here to testify today. I'm here to express our strong concerns about including Oregon Ambulatory Surgery Centers in Senate Bill 454. OASCA is in complete agreement that the healthcare systems in Oregon and America need to be enhanced, streamlined, and made more cost-effective. In order to accomplish this, the last thing we should be doing, in our opinion, is enacting additional reporting and paperwork requirements on one of the few parts of the healthcare industry that runs an incredibly efficient process. Oregon ASCs are small businesses. Many of them have less than 10 employees. As a perspective, our ASC, which is just down the street, we do over 3,000 surgeries a year. We have 44 employees. Despite thoughts to the contrary, Oregon ASCs are not raking in the cash. The average pre-tax margin of an Oregon ambulatory surgery center is 18%, But keep in mind that Oregon ASCs are not tax exempt. We pay property taxes. We pay personal property taxes. Our owners pay federal, state, FICA, SUI, and FUTA taxes. Combined, this is a 50% tax rate, which means that the average net after-tax profit of an Oregon ASC is 9%. That's hardly excessive. It is a fact that some ASCs in Oregon are actually losing money. Many others are barely breaking even. More importantly, ASCs do not embark on major capital budget expenditures that run into the hundreds of thousands, much less the millions of dollars. We don't buy MRIs, we don't buy CT scans, we don't buy PET scans. When we do buy equipment, it's usually in the range of a $100,000 anesthesia machine or a $90,000 microscope. When we do buy equipment, we fund it internally. We do not ask for, we do not float bonds and ask for community support. As a result, asking ASCs to hold community meetings to determine whether it's a prudent idea to buy an anesthesia machine adds a level of administrative burden that does not solve, in our opinion, the public good. Because we don't purchase MRIs, PET scans, CT scans, or other major capital equipment, we don't add to their utilization. It's been said that ASCs do not provide data to help the state understand what we do. Well, that's not true. Starting last year, Oregon ASCs have begun submitting quarterly data to OHPR. The data is by patient and includes data points such as date of birth, sex, zip code, date of admission, principal diagnosis, secondary diagnosis, and the list goes on, including patient race and patient ethnicity. This was a major undertaking for most of the ASCs in the state, simply because many of them did not have the computer systems and the computer support capable of complying with this. The last two items, race and ethnicity, were major undertakings because they had never been collected by ASCs in the past. So for ASCs with 6 to 10 employees, this was a huge administrative burden. I started out by saying that Oregon ASCs, many have fewer than 10 employees. Many are struggling to stay alive, yet ASCs offer patients and society a much lower cost of surgical care. We literally save patients in the healthcare system tens of thousands of dollars, if not millions of dollars. To impose additional record keeping on us really makes no sense. As a result, we respectfully ask that we be removed from Senate Bill 454. Thank you.
Questions? Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Alan Trusseter, and I'm here today representing the Oregon Dental Association. I don't want to repeat anything that Mr. Schlachter said other than say I agree with everything he just said. There are seven oral health ambulatory surgical centers in the state of Oregon. They are very small in size, most of them run by only one or two dentists. They perform generally two major functions. They're owned by oral maxillofacial surgeons who correct birth anomalies or very intensive facial injuries that may occur through an automobile accident or another way. Most of our surgeons are licensed both as dentists and medical doctors. Like Mr. Schlachter said, we don't purchase major diagnostic equipment. We don't have CAT scans or MRIs or any of that other very large. Usually what you'll find is an X-ray machine and perhaps help in technology with administering anesthesiology. These are small businesses, very small. Most have only one or two dentists, and the majority is just one dentist. As a previous witness said, we are private businesses. We are not nonprofits. And so asking for a public comment or public review would be like asking for a public review on the Trusseter Company. You know, should I be in Lake Oswego? That's a good question.
That's not a bad idea.
I knew Dr. Bates would have a response. I mean, the point being that we're not a nonprofit. We don't seek public funds. We're a private business. I believe that you're addressing the issue of medical costs, maybe the most important public policy issue this legislature is tackling. It is a phenomenally difficult issue. But we believe that we're adding on the plus side of that, not the negative side, that we provide a cost-effective service that serves our patients. I would also add that for the oral health ambulatory surgical centers, I mean, we provide a service that is not routinely found in a hospital. You don't generally find a dentist on staff at a hospital. And in the case of a motor vehicle or accident, I mean, the hospital may call in somebody, but with birth anomalies and most routine maxillofacial surgery, the surgery center is the answer to those. So I would, like the previous witness, request that you remove ambulatory surgical centers. I don't think it we contribute to what your overall goal is of looking at unintended capital expenditures and costs to the healthcare system, and in fact, we believe that we contribute to less cost in the healthcare system. And I have talked to Carol Robinson and her staff about this issue, and we're working on if you decide for whatever reason not to exempt us, then there are some other suggestions we have. But our first request would be simply exempt us from this bill.
And you are right. In doing a comparative cost analysis between an ambulatory surgical center and the hospital, cataract surgery for my father was much less at the ambulatory surgical center by several thousand dollars, yet because of the contract, the insurance plan he had to have it at the hospital. So we were paying over $8,000, and it was the same physician.
Yeah.
The same physician was in the ambulatory surgical center, but he also was at the hospital.
Well, and I would just
big difference.
Following up on my colleague Mr. Powell's personal health story, I will tell you that I had lens replacement surgery where they went in and removed my lens and implanted synthetic lens to give me for the first time in my life 20/20 vision. And that was done at an ambulatory surgery center at a cost that was tens of thousands of dollars less than had I done it at the hospital. I was in there for less than 20 minutes, complete surgery in 20 minutes, both eyes, boom. Tremendously effective personally to me. For the first time, I can play with my daughter in a swimming pool and actually see her, and I can go to the ocean and see her at the beach. And I've worn glasses since I was in the second grade, and now I can see, and it saved me literally tens of thousands of dollars to go to the ophthalmological ambulatory surgical center.
Okay. Yes, Senator Bill.
I'll try to control myself. I'm not tell you, Alan, I'm glad you can see straight now, but I just did that one. Okay.
That's probably up to debate, sir.
Yeah, that's it, really. The comments about me have been made also along the same lines, so I suppose we're even. Getting back to this bill, the push and shove between hospitals and ambulatory surgical centers and others has been going on for a long time. Basically, I believe in competition. I think it's a good competition here. The playing field is not completely level. We may not be able to make it completely level. We've had a conversation before about whether or not ambulatory surgical centers take on the full load of care that the hospital lines do with Medicaid, Medicare, and uninsured. Sometimes they're blocked from doing that because contracts won't allow them to access those patients, especially with the MCOs not allowing Medicaid patients to go in there because they've got a capitated rate at the hospital. So it's very complicated. It's not simple. And I have some empathy for both sides in this debate, but generally speaking, I fall on the side of competition's good. What little competition we have in medicine is good. This particular bill may or may not see the light of day again, but I think there's a way around this, and the way around that is to set a monetary value on capital improvements. You know, less than 250,000, index it, pick a number, and below that, you don't have to do anything other than go buy your equipment. Above that, you have to have some public inquiry into it and make your case.
Yeah.
And that may be one of the things you're looking at. I'm not suggesting that's an amendment right now. Let's let the work groups work on it. I think there's ways around. I really, really don't feel good about pulling them out entirely, but giving them some cover I think is important too.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Senator Bates, we have talked with Ms. Robinson about establishing a monetary threshold. I believe that is a path that we could walk down and find a solution. Again, I would, you know, we'd just soon, you don't talk about us in the bill, but if you're going to talk about us, we can, I believe, work with Ms. Robinson and her staff and your staff to find a monetary threshold that would be workable.
Great.
Yes.
Madam Chair, Senator Bass, can I add, the one thing that my only concern with keeping us in having a threshold, for the existing ASCs, that's perfect. I think all of us in the existing ASCs would be fine. The one thing that I don't want to end up with is accidentally discouraging competition, because now, take the example of Eugene, where they've just built two new hospitals. And so some enterprising group of physicians, whatever specialty they are, think, you know what, we can do it cheaper. We can build our own, and we can, as many of you have seen, we can provide this care for less. And for whatever reason, whether it's the community or it's the DHS or whomever, says, you know what, we just allowed two new hospitals into this community. We're not going to allow any other healthcare facilities. So in a sense, we would lock in a higher cost than otherwise would be available to patients if we were allowing the ASCs complete access based on their own competition. So that's my only concern.
So, yes, Senator Morris, and
Thank
then
you.
Senator Bates.
There are a number of issues surrounding this, the relationship between hospitals and ASCs, and the roles that hospitals play versus the ASCs, and if you pull out the margin part of the provider base, you wind up with hospitals that can't provide emergency, they can't provide OB, that doesn't make any money, and you wind up with who cares for the people that can't pay, and right now the hospitals are running about 10%. And I would suggest that your for-profit ASCs probably don't carry those kinds of burdens. So it's a very complicated issue in terms of how we deliver care and still maintaining the viability of our hospitals. And they depend on activities that actually have a margin, because there are many activities that do not have a margin. So,
and we are seeing hospitals expanding into ambulatory surgical centers.
If I might, Madam Chair, if I might respond, Madam Chair and Senator Morse. We did a study just recently of the Oregon ambulatory surgery centers. The average ambulatory surgery center in Oregon, 3.5% of their volume is OHP. Now, that varies. Some do almost none because they're doing, for instance, pain management, and that's below the line, so it's not compensated. Did I say that right? It's not compensated by the Oregon Health Plan. Some do as much as 50% of their volume as OHP. When I talked with Senator Bates the other day, I said that the ASCs in this state do not routinely look at a patient's insurance and say, we're not going to take care of you because you have OHP. We do say, there are comorbidities associated with this patient where they might be a fragile diabetic. We say, gosh, their BMI is so large, it's over 45, we don't feel comfortable doing them. But if your goal is to put more patients into ASCs that have Oregon Health Plan to help reduce the cost, we're ready to help. There are simple solutions that can help push more patients into ASCs. One example is that the Oregon Health Plan does not necessarily reimburse for implants. So if we're doing a shoulder surgery on a patient and there might be $600-$800 worth of implants that go into it, whether it's darts or anything else, if we're fixing an ACL or fixing a broken ankle and the plate might be $400 and the screws are $85 a piece, the Oregon Health Plan doesn't necessarily pay for that. And so if there was some type of administrative directive that said to all the MCOs in the state, we expect that you will pay cost plus 5%. No ASC is going to get rich on that 5%. So if it was cost plus 5%, I know for a fact that many of the ASCs in the state would start saying, great, bring those patients here. We'll do them, and we'll do them at less cost than the hospital will do them. We're happy to do them. Because we know even though we're going to either lose money or break even, it will help cover more of our fixed costs. And so it's just a financially smart thing for us to do, as well as a morally good thing for us to do. ASCs also do provide charity care. Do we provide as much as hospitals? Probably not. But we do provide charity care, and we stand ready to continue to do that.
Anybody? Just a couple of quick comments. You know, it is a complex issue, and that's why I think that this bill doesn't speak to new centers, but a bill should, and a new center should be able to make its case. Yeah. We're not going to cherry-pick the public, and we are going to do our community good, mm-hmm. and we're going to be more efficient. I mean, there's no question, I think they're run more efficiently than hospitals are. I've been in both. Not as a patient, thank goodness, but or maybe should have been, but as a physician. And the efficiency in the centers are dramatic, and the inefficiency in the hospitals are pretty dramatic sometimes, too. On the other hand, hospitals are taking care of everybody. They have to. And there has to be push and shove in this that works. So I think there's room to make this thing work here.
Thank you. Madam Chair, one last comment. Our surgery center is literally two blocks down the street on State Street, State and 14th. If any of you are... If any of you are interested in coming and having a tour, we would love to have you anytime.
We were going to have one the first week we were here as a committee, but things started going so fast that we didn't. But we may have some roll time in June at 8 o'clock in the morning. I don't know.
We'll start at 7 a.m., so
okay.
We'll be ready for you.
All right.
I have been there. So
okay.
Last session we came. So.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. John Rakowitz from AGC, are you here?
Signed up today, Dave Anderson.
Okay, so Dave Anderson and then Bob Shiprock, but I think Jonathan Eames is going to speak for him. So, great.
Madam Chair and the committee, I'm here to talk about Senate Bill 454 today in regards to construction.
And introduce yourself for the record.
Oh, excuse me, David Anderson, president of Anderson Construction Company, Portland. When you think about Senate Bill 454, you've typically been talking about medical indexing costs of patient care and stuff like that. But I'm talking to you today about the impacts of this bill potentially upon construction and the economy generally in the state of Oregon. What we're talking about is the fact that the certificate of need process slows projects down and adds costs to projects. We have been through, we built for Sisters of Providence, Legacy, Tuolumne, Good Sam, OHSU, almost every hospital chain in the Northwest. And we've been through the certificate of need process numerous times on projects. What ends up happening is this redundant kind of circular motion that happens where let's look at your project again, show it to me this way, show it to me that way. It can add years to the project and untold cost, which seems to be going against the grain of let's cut the costs of making healthcare more affordable. So what I'm talking about is when you look at this bill, you need to consider it, particularly in this market right now, you wonder what's left to build currently. Housing, which was our big thing in the last number of years, gone. Retail, basically gone. Commercial construction, which is office and other things, practically gone. So we have really two things that we can do here. One is higher ed, and I'm talking about building construction, not highway heavy construction, but building contractors now can do higher ed and education, and that's having terrific difficulties now, and healthcare. So by enacting a bill like this that has a certificate of need process that causes it to get more complex, you're essentially making this tougher. Currently, in our marketplace, a year ago, we had over 300 employees, about 321 trade people that we employed. Today, I just checked with the payroll department on Monday, they cut the checks. It's about 230. So we're down about 30% currently. And now we're all praying. We tell our people, pray every day that these jobs that we actually have do start, and most of them are healthcare projects. So if, for example, this bill was enacted, you know, there's going to be some time before it kicks in. But you got to consider the market, when you look at all the history of markets and the day that the impact really got to us and how long it took before we got bailed out, it's usually about a 4 or 5 year period of time. So we should have designers down here testifying, because designers are typically feeling it right now. They're into the big layoffs currently. So designers and constructions are always 6 months apart. So the designers are currently in big layoffs. Contractors are going to feel this about 6 months later. We're starting to get the front end of it. So we're going to end up putting a lot of trades at home with nothing to build. So you need to consider the certificate of need piece, just from the standpoint of what's going to happen to the economy. Right now we got an economy that everybody recognizes in dire trouble. You know, this is as worse as we've seen it. You know, maybe not as bad yet, but it can certainly go that way. You know, we're all looking for the bottom. Nobody seems to find it yet, but we're going to see it in construction here pretty soon. So I would urge you to consider the impacts of the cost of certificate of need making the process any more strenuous. Actually, there's a good process in place right now. Like I said, we've been through it numerous times on other projects.
Questions?
Yes, Madam Chair. What's the process you've been through in Oregon?
Senator Bates, typically what happens is we're the guys who provide the information that related to the design and construction costs associated with it. So I've never sat in a meeting that was particularly for the certificate of need. What I've done is gotten the kind of the backlash of it. You know, they're asking more questions. We need more cost information. What if we did this versus that kind of a thing? And so what we've seen is, you know, the year to 2 year process as these things get ruminated and kicked around and what if this. And I got to tell you, oftentimes at the end of the period of time, the project is back to where it almost started again. But yet we've invested a couple $1 million through the design and construction or just the pre-construction process to get there.
I think the vision, the goal would be to make sure that the growth of the healthcare industry is, I take a look at sprawl and say in LA and what we have in Oregon where, and I know some people hate Metro, but we need to get, what we are hoping to get is some kind of handle on the exploding growth of the healthcare facilities, but we don't want to make it more difficult. But it could slow down some of the growth, which in the long run may not be bad if we're just having all these new buildings cropping up. But again, I realize that we're talking jobs here.
Well, this is definitely that. Madam Chair, the big issue that we see is populations are shifting across our state. You take in Portland, you know, people left one area and went out to Hillsborough. There was Quality Health Center in Hillsborough. So you had the one center, basically, if you were in Hillsborough, you went to Quality. So they had the market locked up. So now here comes, you know, St. Vincent's, Sisters of Providence, and they want to put a facility out there because they want to be competitive out there. They want a piece of the market share. And I think it comes back to this capitalistic idea. You know, are you going to try to move the markets yourself? Should government really have a role in that? And I would say as a business guy, no. You know, let capitalism do its thing, because what will happen is some people will make it and some people will fail just by the natures of the market. So you got to be respectful as people move across our land here, you know, and repopulate certain areas. And we're seeing this in education, same thing too. Some schools now are empty. Nobody's there. You know, if you're going to have students in those schools, you're going to have to bus them there. Well, nobody wants to travel. We've got all these kind of competing forces. People are saying, stay out of your cars. Ride light rails. Well, where are the light rails related to the hospitals? You know, hospitals now are starting to orient themselves to light rail systems to take advantage of the transportation. So what happened to the hospital that was kind of in the out-of-the-way place? You know, it goes dark. So it's one of those kind of issues. And as you know, I know you're in healthcare, technology is changing at a rapid pace. We see this as contractors all the time. Hospitals are waiting as long as they possibly can before they push the trigger and say, that's the technology we're going to have that we're going to use in our hospitals. Because everybody, again, competition, you want to have the latest, greatest, you know, the most efficient, most cost-effective approach to delivering healthcare services to your patients. So the certificate of need, I've heard, you know, some of the discussion here. Be careful where you set that price, because the pieces of the equipment are not cheap. And the other thing we run into all the time, certificate of need process, Senator Bates, is the people that are sometimes evaluating the projects really have no understanding of the scale and scope of the issues that are associated with these projects.
And I hear you. I think there can be a balance. I definitely believe that I'd rather be in a capitalistic society than any other society in the world, for that matter. But I take a look at what's happened, say, with the banks, and we did. We deregulated them. And things did really run amok, and the housing industry was a part of that problem. And so I think there can be a happy balance, but and I'll leave it at that. Yeah.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Just a few comments, if I could. I understand what you're saying. I'm a physician, as you probably know, and have watched hospitals build, and hospitals have not, at this point, failed yet, but we're looking at some of these situations to make sure. Some of those failures may be from overexpansion of building, building hospitals that weren't needed, beds that weren't needed, and in facilities that were too expensive and inappropriate. I would offer that if most hospitals had to go out, like a school district does, and get funding from the public, they might have a real difficult time passing the muster on that. And a lot of times we're seeing new hospitals built for what we call market share. Not where there's need, but because there's market share. Much of it driven by the payer mix in a given area versus a payer mix in another area. There's very complex issues here. Certificate of need has been proven to work in some areas and not work in others. It can be too bureaucratic. It can drive up costs and ends up everybody gets okay in the end anyway. That's not the purpose. But I can sit down with you and point out three or four hospital projects that have been done in this state in the last 4 or 5 years, which I think are unnecessary. You put those hospitals at risk. Somebody has to pay for it. One of them is in my area that I look at every day. I see empty floors in one part of the hospital and a brand new tower on the other side, and no value to patients as far as cost is concerned, or efficiency, or improvement in their outcomes. So it's a mixed bag, and I accept that from you. I think certificate of need, as the chair said, has a real value. It may not have been applied well in Oregon. And with the question I'd asked you originally, you really can't answer it. I can see why. You have not been in the midst of the certificate of need process, because I don't think they have one in Oregon. And I think it's very minimal, very confusing, and probably doesn't have much value in itself at this point. But I do believe we need some type of certificate of need to guide the system.
Madam Chair.
Senator,
well, I'd like to say that the certificate of need in Lane County did drag on and added to the cost of what I consider a very good new hospital, but it did last for 2 years, and it was ridiculous.
If I may comment, Senator Morissette, Senator Bates, we also build in Alaska, and Alaska's got a very difficult certificate of need process. And we've been the pre-construction entity providing support as they went through the design process and went through the certificate of need loop process to get that done. And it took years and cost, you know, millions of dollars to make that happen. And ultimately, again, it ended up pretty much as they started out.
Right.
It's just everybody had to put their fingerprints on it. You know, that's a lay perspective of that. I know the hospital you're speaking of, and yes, they went through a terrible process, and a lot of that was competition driven. You know, I don't want you to build a new hospital because you're coming into my turf, so I'm going to make it as difficult as you possibly can to get you there. And that's going to happen too. I do think, you know, capitalism has got to work. It's magic, otherwise the whole system fails. And I don't know how you do that exactly. You know, the banks is a classic case of, I think, fraud and greed and all sorts of things that got into there. If you can find a way to you know, put your fingers on that in the healthcare system. And I typically, I don't see it myself, fraud and greed per se, but almost every hospital we work for is a nonprofit. You know, so they tend to have a good vision driven by a mission that is basically, let's support the needs of the patients and the communities and such. And I don't see a lot about let's gain profits. In fact, they don't really call them profits. They call them...
Well, it's market share, and they are going out for market share. A hospital with a, well, I think Senator Morissette said a four-story fireplace and beautiful fountains.
But it will last forever.
So we want ugly buildings?
Anyway, we need to move on. We still have four people left. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your time.
Can you let Jonathan talk?
Yes.
Thank you, Senator Goodson. Chairman Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jonathan Eames. I'm actually here on behalf of Bob Shipwreck. So if you do have any negative comments, please save them for Bob. okay for me. Actually, a lot of the discussion that Oregon Building Trades wanted to have, or at least make the points here today, have been already touched upon. But I think Senator Morissette's comments are really what Bob wanted to emphasize, is these laws are often used to simply punish competition from coming in. And that does no good for the process, especially if that's necessary. I understand Senator Bates' concerns about whether it's appropriate, but when laws are used by one person in the or one group in the marketplace simply to prevent competition, that's adding cost when it's unnecessary, and it stifles competition. And you know, the conversation we've had about ambulatory surgery centers is a good example. You know, if folks are going to use these laws and these regulations to prevent other groups from coming in, it's really not serving the right purpose. So I think as far as the building trades really wanted to emphasize that point and say, you know, but, you know, Bob's been asked to come in and on behalf of one group or another group, you know, in the Eugene situation particularly, where he was asked to, you know, to be there for one group or another group, and that's not right. That's not the way it should be. It really should be based on another set of measures. So we also obviously represent the third-party administrators in the first section of the bill we have a problem with, too. The gentleman from Lane Powell spoke about that, Jeff Knapp, on Monday, so I won't touch on that. I know you guys want to hear it, but I won't touch on that, so thank you.
Madam Chair, yes, I need to clarify my statement. I was very concerned during that process about our small community hospital. I've had a different experience, and I'm looking at the big picture and at the results of what happened, and I'm satisfied with the way it happened. And it is a market share, and it is about competition. But my little hospital will be okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. Let's call Carol Robinson, Henry Kramer, and Grant Higginson up. Those are the last three. And Carol has to leave, and so let's let the proponent of the bill come forward or be first.
Thank you, Chair Monis Anderson, committee members. My name is Carol Robinson. I'm interim director of the Oregon Health Fund Board. And for those who did not get to hear the testimony that I presented on Tuesday on Senate Bill 454, there's a few things that I'd like to clarify for you. First of all, it's been fascinating to listen to the testimony this morning, and I think some clarification about what this bill is and what it is not is really important. First of all, the bill, Senate Bill 454, is not a one-size-fits-all bill. It is a transparency bill, and it's not a certificate of need bill, but it is a community engagement, community review bill. And I think that those are important clarifications for you to consider. Senate Bill 454 will improve Oregon's ability to ascertain variation in healthcare pricing and insurance coverage at the community level and the regional level. And this is important because of cost trends in different areas of the state can be compared. So understanding exactly what Senator Bates was referring to earlier about different costs for procedures in one community versus another is important information for the state to be able to understand. And then further drilling down, the line of sight between provider price increases in a local market and the resulting changes of health insurance premiums would also allow us to drive better better contracting. And it provides a window for the state to evaluate healthcare facility and technology investments. Extending that line of sight even further down gives us the ability to track the link between premium cost changes and the loss of commercial insurance coverage in localities. And we would like to do this by zip code and by business lines. And I think that this would give the state the ability to not only spot the canary in the coal mine of a very kind of pun to a sick healthcare market, but also be able to see where we're doing well. And I think those are important tools. In addition to tracking those, the data by zip code and business line, Senate Bill 454 does require insurers and third-party administrators to report their administrative rate increases on a per-member, per-month basis. And so I included a graph the other day in your testimony that shows the difference between medical CPI and CPI. And if you still have that available, I can, it's growing at a rate that's more than double. And if the if that medical cost trend is related to a whole lot of things in other bills that the Health Fund Board has brought forward, and important ways for us to change that, including the evidence-based standard clinical guideline bill that you heard about earlier. But why the administrative costs are going up at the same rate is a question that I think the Health Fund Board would like to see answered. I said this wasn't a one-size-fits-all bill, and I heard the concerns that John Powell issued, but the bill does allow for flexibility in the review of the administrative rates. So if there was a large-scale investment being made by an insurer around health information technology, for example, there would be an ability to justify the increase above CPI, and that evaluation has that mechanism included. The third area where SB 454 brings more transparency and accountability is in Section 8, and that's the community input, that community engagement and review process. And the other day I gave you a couple examples. I think you have referred to some of those this morning as well. There's an ability, if communities know earlier, some of the feedback that happened in Eugene around the construction of the new hospital, the contention was not as much around the hospital itself, but around some of the issues of transportation and urban planning. And so the earlier information that could have been available to local decision makers would have been very helpful. And it would have been helpful to the state as well in their certificate of need deliberations. And another example is the frustration that some people in Portland felt around the construction of a new, another pediatric tertiary site, hospital. And there was no ability for the community to really express those concerns about the need. And so those are important tools for citizens to have. We are able to weigh in on our opinions about investments made by school districts and libraries and road improvements and other kinds of public investment that affects our costs. And I think that large expenditures by health facilities should be no different. Finally, the ability to be able to get all of those claims into one standardized form has the potential for amazing cost savings. And Senate Bill 454 has the ability to do that as well. In Minnesota, they are now seeing this done, and it's all transferred electronically. And the cost savings that we are witnessing in that state from those changes are fairly remarkable. So the Health Fund Board supports Senate Bill 454 and believes that it would change the paradigm where consumers have little voice in healthcare investments in their community and little ability to understand those driving factors in the healthcare costs that we're all concerned about. Transparency has to come first, and that's what this bill is about, before we can really change the market and drive change. And so we know that we can make a substantial difference in reducing those cost variations once we have that information. So we encourage that. Thank you.
Thank you, Carol.
Madam Chair, yes. I won't comment now. I have several things that I will, next time we hear this in relationship, and I know the hearings officer here is going to talk about some things that happened in Lane County.
Thank you.
So.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dr. Grant Higginson. I'm the administrator of the Office of Community Health.
And Carol, if you need to leave, you can.
I've got 5 more minutes.
Okay.
The Office of Community Health and Health Planning, Public Health Division, Department of Human Services. And at the hearing on Tuesday and then again today, a number of objections have been raised about Section 8 of Senate Bill 454 that would require the public hearing and information sharing. And I'm here today because one of the programs in my office is the Certificate of Need program, and a number of references to that program have been made, so I wanted to provide some clarification. The first issue is that there's been concern that Section 8 creates new onerous requirements that hospitals and ambulatory surgical centers would now need to comply with. And opponents of the bill said that this is something that they're already doing, so why do we have to have these new requirements? And I guess that's my point, is that if they're already doing this, why is this going to be an additional burden? All of the information that would be required, the cost of the project, what it's going to mean in the way of payment increases by patients, what the effects are going to be on the community. All that information is already being collected and compiled through the planning process, so I just don't see why that is an additional onerous burden on the facilities. And I just think that convening a public meeting to explain the project and the effects that it would have on the community is something that's an expectation that should be something that's accepted by anyone that's investing that kind of dollars in a new capital project. Another issue is that there's concern over creating more regulation and adding an additional layer of bureaucracy that would add to costs and delays. And I do want to point out that, at least as I read it, there are new requirements to the bill, but there is no new regulatory oversight, and there is no mechanism even to ensure that compliance with the provisions of the bill are occurring. So I just don't see that there's this new regulatory or oversight or an additional layer of bureaucracy. Opponents to this section also mentioned that it takes months and months for a planning process to be completed by a facility, and I again just don't see how adding one public meeting to that planning process is going to delay construction up to years, as we heard in earlier testimony today. The third thing is that statements were made that, at least I thought, implied that these new provisions were not necessary because we already have a certificate of need process in place. And I think you all know that we do have a long-established mechanism with certificate of need for obtaining public input and trying to use that input to come up with some rational decisions based on established criteria. But I do need to point out that certificate of need is only only applicable on the acute care side in a very, very few number of cases. Right now, it's really just for new hospitals, and sometimes that includes a relocation, but it's just for new hospitals, and it doesn't include ambulatory surgical centers at all. And another program in my office is a facility plans review process, and I asked for some information, and I haven't double-checked this data, so I'm a little cautious, but I asked them to look at the number of projects over the last 8 years, which we have data on, that were over $1 million. And there were 157 projects over $1 million. Five of those have gone through certificate of need. So, I mean, there just isn't that certificate of need oversight right now. The other thing I want to point out is contrary to what Mr. Anderson was saying today, this bill is not an expansion of the certificate of need process. In fact, we weren't even involved in the development of the bill, and we weren't even actively tracking this bill until we started hearing that there were complaints because somehow it was related to certificate of need, which it just is not. And then the final point that I want to make is that when certificate of need is involved, this kind of public input would be something that would be valuable for us. And I think it would be valuable for all policymakers as well. And Senator Morissette has raised the issue about how long certificate of need took in the Eugene area. And it did take a long time, and it was a very, very contentious situation down there. I would remind people, though, that it was two projects that we reviewed and not just one project. But to me, having this kind of information would have made our job a whole lot easier. You know, what we really look at in certificate of need is bed need and financial solvency of the facility and its proposal. The issues that we were confronted with were transportation, the siting of hospitals, disaster preparedness. Those are issues that are really outside of certificate of need. And if there was a public process to get those issues raised early, it would be very helpful for policymakers at the local level to be making those informed decisions. And so I'm going to close by saying that, you know, I was fortunate to be involved in the Health Fund Board process. The thing I heard over and over and over again was increase transparency, make sure there's public input into decisions that are being made, and that's exactly what I see Section 8 of 454 doing.
Thanks. Madam Chair, just a brief comment. There was a public process in place. Transplan Lane County said don't put a major facility on the urban fringe, and exactly what we did. We took the furthest place from that we could possibly put a hospital. So there was a planning process that was ignored.
Madam Chair.
Yeah.
First of all, especially if it's a prevailing wage project, you can't hardly build an outhouse for under $1 million anymore. So $1 million is not a magic number anymore. I would suggest that if all you're wanting is to have a public meeting, then just take sub 2 of Section 8. But sub 3 of Section 8, establish other requirements, is an open door.
Okay. Mr. Kramer,
mm-hmm.
You're the last one. Go for it.
We'll take a couple minutes, so it shouldn't be too bad. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Henry Kramer. I'm appearing on behalf of the Oregon Bus Project and in favor of Senate Bill 454. I don't have a whole lot to add to what's already been said. Most of it makes sense. The bill will help control, you know, the precariously high cost of health care, cut red tape out of our health care system, and offer a much-needed window into where our money's going. But as the bus project's mission is largely to bring young people into the process, I'd like to speak more to how this bill and other cost-cutting measures in general will particularly help young people. And you know, as you've heard, soaring costs of health care are endangering countless families across Oregon and across the country, and that hits young people harder than most. You know, young people are the largest block of uninsured people, and it's largely due to costs. According to the National Institute for Healthcare Management, 18 to 29-year-olds are, like I said, the most likely demographic to be uninsured. And while we make up 17% of the population under 65, we make up 30% of the uninsured population under 65. And this is largely due to cost. According to a study done by the Commonwealth Fund, two-thirds of uninsured youth go without coverage only due to cost. And just as with the general population, it's not only the uninsured that have concerns about costs. 42% of young people expressed in a survey done by the Kaiser Family Foundation that they were concerned about the rising cost of health care. And these cutting costs benefits everybody, not just the uninsured, benefits all Oregonians, young and not so young. And Senate Bill 454 is an important step toward that process. By limiting jumps in administrative costs due to inflation, or you know, just to those due to inflation or justified necessities, we'll keep more money in Oregonians' pockets, which is vital right now. By transitioning to common electronic forms and processes for administrative purposes, healthcare providers can keep more money, save more money, and pass those savings on to consumers. And by bringing the information to the open, it'll empower Oregon's watchdogs to bring costs down and keep them low. And that's really all I have to say. For those reasons, the Bus Project urges you to support Senate Bill 454. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Thank you very much for coming, both of you. We're not done with this bill. There'll be some work done on it. I want to read into the record that the Oregonians for Health Security have written testimony that I think each of you was given, and I think will be read into the or will be put into the record. With that, any questions?
Carry over 451.
Okay, I would like to carry over Senate Bill 451 next Tuesday.
Okay.
Whatever date that is from today. All right.
Whenever we meet. Day after Monday.
All right. Well, first I got to close the public hearing on Senate Bills 454 and then open a public hearing on 451 to carry it over to next Tuesday. Close the public hearing on 451. Oh, yes.
Madam Chair. Yes. I move the rules to be suspended to allow Senator Morissette to vote on Senate Bill 605.
Senator Cruz moves to rescind the suspend the rules to allow Senator Morissette to vote on Senate Bill 605. Is there any discussion?
Well, I've learned how he feels about tort reform before I can suspend the rules.
is there any objection?
No.
So ordered.
Aye.
No. Now you...
We suspend the rules. Now we can vote.
How do you vote?
Aye.
You have that recorded? All right. Okay. We'll close the public work session on Senate Bill 605 or whatever we had to do there. And then we are adjourned.